What I plan to do is to say a little bit about how information affects is used by, talked about by sociologists, by way of framing what follows, and also introducing something of my disciplinary affiliation. And in talking about sociology, a lot of what I'm saying really applies to the breadth of social sciences. So I sort of sometimes slip from sociology to social sciences. I think sociology, at the risk of sounding a bit arrogant, is to social sciences a bit like, I don't know what the right thing would be, but physics is to science or something of that. Or, I mean, other people might contest that, obviously. But it's, in some sense, is a foundational discipline of the social sciences. So I'm talking really, in some ways, in broad terms, about how the social sciences have taken on board and are shaped by developments relating to information. For me, and I'm going to say a little bit that Frank Webster would have talked about, which is the information society thesis, which, as I'll be talking about in a minute, is the main way in which social scientists have taken on board how it is that information is transforming all sorts of dimensions of contemporary society. I'll mention very, very briefly a few other approaches to that kind of macro sense of transformation with new forms of information. And we'll then move on to talk a bit about interactivity. Then, so a bit of a break after that. I then want to say something, this is the main part of what I'm saying, which is about the challenge to the social sciences of commercial databases. And I want to talk about how the volume of information and who it's owned by and how it's used is of a very, very different order today from even at the time when I trained in sociology, and certainly when sociology was founded, if you like, 100 years ago or so. And I'm then going to come back to the interactivity issue or debate that I've opened up by talking a bit about work that I'm doing. It's an AHRC-funded study, Arts and Humanities Research Council-funded study that I'm doing at the BBC World Service at the moment, looking at how they are measuring interactivity. So I'm, if you like, tying the notion of interactivity up with these vast, often commercial databases. And then I'll just say a couple of words about what all of this means, what the volume and scope and ownership of this information means for the social sciences today. Well, the main way in which social scientists have looked at information is in terms of the information society thesis, which is a rather umbrella term to cover an eclectic set of work which talks about the transformation of all sorts of empirical areas of society. The world of work, which is becoming restructured, the growing interdependence of economies, so think of the US subprime market affecting your or my economic situation today, the Greek bailout, the increasing volume and rate of cultural circulation, ways in which movements and fashion and so forth have become more global, new kinds of political campaigning, whether it's countercultural or in presidential elections, the growth of surveillance, the transformation of warfare with drones being driven from people in Minnesota rather than anyone getting their hands dirty in Pakistan, and so on and so forth. So there's all sorts of dimensions of society that you can talk about having been transformed with the growth of databases and computers and so forth. And you can add those together and say that together this constitutes something of a new kind of society in which information offers some kind of foundational status, as, say, under Marx, labour and capital would have done. So these have been the things that people have historically talked about as being the key factors organising the social. And all of these are contested, and some people look at, you know, one of these areas, and some people, notably Frank Webster, who, you know, would have liked to have been here today, has synthesised this material and has published a lot of stuff on the information society, in which there's really a pretty fundamental debate about whether changes of quantity constitute a change of quality In other words, if you have, at what point does more of something make it something different? So is it a fundamentally different sort of society, or is it the same kind of society where we're using computers rather than calculators or quill pens or something of that order? This is not the first of the information society isn't the first way of conceiving of macro changes in society. Perhaps one of the best known is Daniel Bell's post-industrial society thesis, which came out sort of late 60s, 70s. Eminent right-wing American sociologist who talked about something that you'll no doubt be familiar with, of the decline of employment in extractive and agriculture, primary sector. Nowadays, the decline of manufacturing in the Western world, its movement to China, and the growth of a service sector. If you take three sectors of the economy, one's been down for a long time, one's gone down fairly recently, and the other is the third, the tertiary sector, services, is going up. And this is what Daniel Bell and others talk about as deindustrialization. So that's a connected or similar kind of approach to the information society thesis. You can see the information society thesis as building on that in many ways. And most recently, or one of the more recent such macro approaches to conceiving of transformation of society with the growth of information and IT is Manuel Castells' Network Society. Castells, who's a well-known, on the postcard of the book, he's described as the best-known philosopher of cyberspace, which isn't quite how I describe him, but he's a remarkably multicultural, multinational person, spans most continents of the world in both visiting chairs but also empirical research. So it's a very macro account that he develops of how the world today is characterized by networks. Networks become the key organizational form. And he talks about flows along networks between nodes. You can think of a network could be, I get out of my depth, drug barons in Venezuela, they're not in Venezuela, are they, but Colombia, through to sort of people selling drugs on the streets of London with various kind of intermediaries, which include money going into this. And so you could draw a sort of network, flows of drugs, money, people, and so forth. And these are network, and you could think banking, or they don't have to be illegitimate in any sense. But he's saying that this is the modern organizational form, and networks have particular characteristics. And they're such that he talks about the informational mode of development, by which he means a form of social organization in which information generation, processing, transmission become the fundamental sources of productivity and power. So that's a bit like kind of Marx's labor and capital, if you like. So information comes to be. I mean, he sort of hedges his bets a bit because he says it's still capitalism. But he talks about a mode of development which is informational. So the way in which information is organized, structured, and flows shapes how society is organized. Now, for me, one of the things that's missing from Castells' account, which I find very persuasive, he does a most remarkable breadth of empirical research. He's got doctoral students all over the world, and he draws on about 50 of his current students, PhDs, in writing these rather annoying blockbusters, 3 times 400 pages to get the full story of the network society. I think he could write a bit more briefly, but it is a far-reaching analysis, which is much more than globalization. It covers all aspects of society. He's not suggesting that everyone is globally connected. Indeed, many people are globally disconnected. So if you've only got to kind of say at Heathrow, you've got people passing through on their way to Frankfurt or wherever it might be. You also got people who will never get out of Ealing, where they live and work in Heathrow. So it's not suggesting that everyone is kind of transnational. But that these networks are the key way in which society is organized and structured. His networks, for me, miss out a very important element of the area that I work in, which is that the flow across networks is not one way. And certainly in the area that I'm working at the moment, new media, interactivity seems to me to be the defining feature. And interactivity is shaping the social in all sorts of ways. So organisations are restructuring because of ways in which customers, as we now call students, are kind of feeding back into systems. We can look at ways in which, I'm thinking here of open space or avatars, a whole variety of ways in which people can express themselves in political terms, build movements, organisations, lobbying with blogs and so forth. And particularly and very obviously with new forms of cultural production. Jenkins talks about the growth of participatory culture where users are involved in creating as well as consuming content. And the most sort of extreme and best example of this is perhaps gaming, where it's only in use that a game kind of comes to life, comes to be what it is. A producer does so much, but then a user does more. But one can also look at fan communities, the engagement of fan communities. This is Harry Jenkins sort of stuff, in determining plot lines for television series. So people talk online about what's going on almost in real time, and the next episode or the last episode hasn't yet been written. And viewers thus shape the direction of plots. A fascinating one that I heard about the other day was Lego, as in plastic toy bricks, but they've also got quite clever things with motors and so forth. In my day it was bricks, but it's got a bit more sophisticated. And Lego now does its design very largely through an online community of fans, so it doesn't need much in the way of in-house engineers. And it sets people problems, and people all over the world work through the night, come up with solutions, mail them back, and all Lego does is send them a box of bricks in return. So you've got a community which has shaped the development of a product. And by engaging these people, it doesn't have to be Lego, but it could be anything, fan communities are shaping the direction of the organisation. And innovation depends on their active engagement, which is becoming more complex and more elaborate. So in a whole variety of ways, we're seeing a growth of collaboration, participation, and openness. Now, social media is perhaps the most obvious example of this process. And a number of different... in a whole variety of... In politics, this is often seen as democratising, radical, progressive, and so forth, connected with similar movements, open source, and such like. In the media world, then a couple of key phrases are user-generated content and citizen journalism, ways in which users are engaged in production as well as consumption. Al Jazeera, for example, in Cairo in the spring, gave out mobile phones and set up a website to which people could download still and moving images. And they then based television programs, the news, around that which was coming in from people on the square. At the moment in Syria, there are no official journalists. So everything that you know about Syria is coming out of citizen journalism. The BBC doesn't have anybody in Syria. The BBC doesn't have anyone in Libya. The last Libyan who worked for the BBC was shot on the steps of Bush House some years ago, actually, in central London. So citizen journalism has been central for, one could say, shaping the movement, as in achieving political progress, but certainly providing the content for Al Jazeera in particular. The BBC, of course, being a more stuffy organisation, didn't want to use this stuff because it's not verified. So the BBC's reputation depends on checking facts. And Al Jazeera did put stuff out that was a year old. In other words, it was claiming to be what's happening now because someone had said that, but it wasn't. Now, the BBC would never make that mistake. On the other hand, Al Jazeera had an immediacy to it, a very different sense, more of a sense of conversation, something more personal, and so forth. And this is very, very different from the broadcast model of the media. So the broadcast model, broadcasting is one-to-many by definition. And as Raymond Williams says in his wonderful History of Television, it's not inherent in the technology that it developed in that way. So, funnily enough, radio started as one-to-one, point-to-point, ship-to-shore. Telephone started as a broadcasting system, but each of those has ended up as the opposite. But this kind of, the flows that are involved in citizen journalism and user-generated content are very different from the one-to-many model, and they're a challenge to traditional media organisations, which isn't to attribute agency to Twitter or something like that. I mean, there's a strong argument that the revolution only happened in Egypt when the electricity got switched off, so everyone got off Facebook and went downtown, and after that, things changed. So I'm not wanting to be too deterministic about the technology in this process. But these social media gather vast amounts of data about contemporary life. It's not just geodemographic data, which is there in abundance, but it's also about social experiences, which people talking about their pleasures and frustrations and so forth. And a lot of it is openly accessible, in part because it's rooted in a culture of self-promotion and exposure rather than by people who have particular concerns about privacy. And if we look at the data that's in these, on Facebook, for example, it's extraordinarily rich. A rather well-known resource in the UK is the Mass Observation Archive, based now at the University of Sussex, which was people writing. They got 200 people to write about work this week, and they got 200 people to write about the royal wedding one week. So there's a lot of people who've written accounts of things. But the richness of what's on Facebook is extraordinary compared to such archives and compared to anything that sociologists might generate. And this has led to Mike Savage and Roger Burrows in particular making an argument that sociology is perhaps under threat or in need of some transformation. They argue that sociology was built on some tools which were developed and applied by sociologists. So they're kind of what we did, the interview and the sample survey, which are both extraordinarily effective devices, both very, very widely used. And these things went from the academy to commercial and government organisations. They were developed by academics. And today, however, they've been eclipsed, and the example that they give, which is a particularly powerful one, is by these very large organisations which incidentally work with proprietary algorithms, so we don't quite know what they do with the data, to merge a breadth of official data, half of its official data roughly, from in the UK, I'm talking about the UK, but similar things apply in other developed countries. The decennial census, but also various other government surveys. Other official records like county court transactions and so forth. The electoral register. And a lot of commercial data, which is to do with credit ratings, credit worthiness, transactional data. And they merged that with postcodes. So there are two particular organisations and systems. The systems are known as Acorn and Mosaic. So it's a classification of residential neighbourhoods is the first one. I can't remember what the other one is. They're two sort of rival companies, but they were both actually developed by the same guy who moved from one company to the other. They gather vast amounts of data on an area, on a very small geographical area. And as I'll be talking about later, my sort of equivalent of this that I'm working on is looking at the geodemographics and sentiment of social media users, where again we can look, in this case in real time, and generate vast amounts of data. So that's London postcodes, very small sorts of areas. And each of these systems classify the UK, in the case of Mosaic, into 11 groups and 61 subtypes. So at the top, they have labels like happy families. One of them is B09 fledgling nurseries. And then it describes the sort of place that these people might live, the kind of names that they might have. And 10% of the British population is in this group. So by and large, they've got kids, might be in new suburb. Milton Keynes would be full of these people, I should imagine. Mostly white with humour. And it says what me. And this is just a very simple account of the... it goes down through... And then this is the other one. This is extending it a bit, but I'll skip through this. So we can then come up with a neighbourhood where we see a typical house. This is group A2. Might live in a house like this. And then we can click on the probabilities of particular marital statuses, age, ethnicity. And this is just a slide dumped here, so I can't scroll down. But you can get all sorts of data about this neighbourhood. And these are terms that we might, a word cloud that we might associate with it. And then I clicked on one of these things, which is how green we are. And in this area, which is where I live... a lot of us, millions of us actually, are eco-evangelists and so forth. So we can identify, this identifies in a number of dimensions our approach to green issues, but we could do it in relation to anything else. You can see what newspapers people read. I'm about to move house, actually, and I live in a kind of Guardian reading area, a Guardian Observer, and we were interested in buying a house in a rather nice place, but they were Times and Telegraph readers, which made me very... aware of it. So you can see this, you can go and have a look at this stuff. You can have a sort of 10 sample goes without paying anything, but by and large they sell this information. You can see how much of us are in debt by how much and what we consume and so on and so forth. This is called political attitudes, which intrigues me because in one sense there's nothing about political parties here or about commitment to equality or anything like that. It's about our approach to life, if you like. And again, surveyed in the most remarkable detail. Then this is the Acorn one, which is a similar kind of classification, which then describes a particular neighbourhood, which is the one where I live. And it says that... Well, anyway, you can read it for yourself. So these organisations sell this data, but... they have much more influence. It's not simply a market situation. The data is used by government bodies for planning and delivery of services, insurance companies, pension funds, so your life, how much you pay for insurance premiums determined by the postcode, call line identification, queuing systems at call centres. If you're an attractive customer, you get your telephone answered more quickly. This retailers, if John Lewis are thinking of opening in your area, they look at this stuff and decide where to locate their shops, and so on and so forth. So in all sorts of ways, these systems are shaping life chances and the structure of the society that we live in. But actually very few people know about them. And interestingly enough, of course, they're not regulated by any of the ethics that academic researchers are. So they're... Obviously, they comply with data protection legislation to a degree, but they don't have to go through the same procedures as we do in terms of ethics approval, which is... And the best-known use of this is Dunnhumby, which is an organisation now owned by Tesco, which started working for Tesco, which developed Tesco's club card, so a loyalty card at a supermarket, and that's what's attributed with Tesco's relative success over other supermarkets over the years. It's using this data to then market particular products in particular. You know, vegetarians are likely to live in CF60, so you put vegetarian food there and so on, and so it goes on. Now, Nigel Thrift argues that this is what we now live in, can be called informational capitalism, where software and information are being used to order the social, and not just order it, become key agents in the social. Now, so that's the the framework for my approach to these massive databases. And it's an analysis which was developed by Mike Savage and Roger Burrows. They wrote a paper in Sociology 2007, The Coming Crisis in Empirical Sociology. And it created a bit of a buzz, because what it was saying was that sociologists are going to have to rethink what they do. They're no longer the owners of the people who gather the data, but nor are they people who've developed the tools whereby it's not just gathered but also analysed. So we've kind of lost it to commercial organisations. So where does that leave the role of the academy? Now, my own work, as I said, is on new media and particularly interactivity. And I'm working at the BBC World Service, which broadcasts in currently 29 languages as well as English, basically to the, all around the world. It's a part of the BBC which is funded by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, not the BBC licence payer, as a part of public diplomacy. Public diplomacy is talking to overseas publics as opposed to overseas diplomats. Governments talk government to government through diplomats. This is about engaging overseas publics. That's what the World Service is about. It was founded circa 1930, in the early 1930s, and played a major role in the Cold War, and nowadays a major role in the Middle East. It closed down the Eastern Bloc services and opened up television in the Middle East. It delivers on television, mostly radio, but also websites and mobile websites. And this, the interactivity that is allowed by the websites raises all sorts of interesting questions for the BBC, like any other media organisation. They're very, very good at measuring audiences. How many people are listening to us, for how long, and then you have what's called appreciation indices. How much do they like what they're listening to? So sometimes few people listen, but they like it a lot. So that's how media organisations measure who they're talking to. Now people are talking back, which makes it much more complicated. But also, they're talking to one another without involving the BBC. So the BBC hosts websites on which, for example, Islamic fundamentalists talk to one another about what's wrong with the United States. And these people may be in Los Angeles, London, and Iran. Actually, Iran, the BBC's blocked in Iran, but nonetheless, people are using it in Iran. BBC's blocked in a couple of countries at the moment, China. So this raises new problems of measurement. How does the BBC know its audience? And what it does is to measure this in new ways, and it's just getting this off the ground. Very exciting times. Through social media analytics. And what these do is provide a package called Sysomos, is what they do, developed by a couple of Canadians in a garage, from what I can work out, provides key geodemographics on all social media users. It trawls them for content and also for geodemographic information. And with things like Facebook, much of the information is private, but it works out from where people are. Nonetheless, it does extra work on Facebook to work out the characteristics of the people who are involved. More than this, it then connects debate, for example, on Twitter, to what it calls sentiment, using natural language processing. Now, I'm slightly wary of this. So it provides information on what the buzz is, what people are talking about, but also how they're talking about it. Is it positive? Is it negative? So are they approving of what the BBC is saying, or approving of what the British government's doing, perhaps, or are they not talking about it? And it also provides you with your performance relative to Al Jazeera or whoever. And in looking at these social media users, they're not just individuals in a place with particular demographic characteristics, but think of Twitter. They can also identify who are key influencers, those who are more followed than they're followed, and so forth. So it can then focus particularly on key influence. This is a marketing tool designed for selling BMW cars or something of that sort. So you can see what people are saying about the brand. BMWs are great. BMWs are hopeless. The wheels are good. I don't know. But it's much more complex when you start dealing with debates about politics, but nonetheless it's in its early stages, and they're spending a lot of money at the BBC trying to make it work. And you can produce in real time charts like this, which show you that at the moment there's 3,000 people on Twitter. Most of them are on Twitter, the blue bit of the pie chart, And you can I told it here to look at BBC Arabic, and you can then, you know, mine down through that, and you can see you get spikes at different times. In times of crisis, people resort to international media much more. So you get spikes with particular when Gaddafi's found, it will go off the Richter scale. This shows the demographics in terms of age and gender. These people are, by and large, remarkably well-educated, young and male. That's the, compared to radio and compared to the population as a whole. And we can see where they are in this situation. They're mostly in Bahrain and Egypt and the UK. And we can see the sort of things that are being talked about. And we can see the connections, though unfortunately this is in Arabic, but this works in 80 languages simultaneously, which is why it's the package that was chosen by the World Service. So they can amass a vast amount of data. They're looking at where people using the World Service are also talking. So this provides a vast amount of data which could be useful in terms of their justification of their funding. Now, all broadcasters have to know who's using them, most of them to get advertising revenue, so many people of a particular kind. In the case of a public service broadcaster, BBC, to justify the licence fee. In the case of the World Service, to justify the funding, which at the moment comes from the Foreign Office. So it has a line of accountability, and it has to show that it's informing debates or, ideally, changing opinions. So it's got to show effectiveness in some kind of way. And these packages, they're only just being thought about and scarcely introduced at the moment. I'm working with them on this. So there's a vast amount of data which is necessary because of the interactivity of the new tools, and because there are new approaches to research are needed because of the vast amount of information and it's facilitated by the technology. Now, going back to the general sense, and I'll just be 2 minutes now. Sociology has not been unsuccessful, but sociologists have gone out there to work for market researchers. They also colonise business studies departments. There's sociologists in computing departments and so on and so forth. If you read magazines and newspapers now, they've got articles in them that wouldn't have been in newspapers 20 years ago. They would have been in specialist sociology journals. And you've also got the growth of these commercial organisations. So where does that leave the social sciences? And I suppose my line, and that of many other people, is that we have to kind of engage with these bodies of data, hence my negotiating access to the BBC, which is actually quite a nightmare. I mean, in some senses, it's a fairly closed organisation, despite being a public service broadcaster. To work with them, or to try working with Tesco's on their consumption data would be absolutely remarkable. But obviously, it involves questions of ethics, of access, of independence, and so forth. Okay, thank you very much.